So, we're now going to get on to the final century, the 20th century. And the title I've given to this chapter in my book is Wars of Irreligion. And I know somebody said that that they are fearing that they're going to be depressed after this. Which I, you know, should not really be the case, because the whole point of the book is that we're dealing with a tapestry. And in every century, there's the good, the bad, and the beautiful. And yes, there's a lot of bad stuff happening in the 20th century. There's also an awful lot of good stuff and beautiful stuff happening in the 20th century. The 20th century is not worse than the 9th or the 10th centuries, for instance. And as I think I said, the talk before last, maybe it was the last talk, that the year 1800 was arguably the worst year in the church's history thus far, where the Pope himself had basically banned the only fighting part of the church, the Jesuits, in order to kowtow to the power of absolutist monarchs and revolutionary France. So times had been very bad prior to the 20th century. Okay, so on to the 20th century, and as is with keeping with our tapestry, we will begin with the good. As we move towards the conclusion of this 2,000-year survey of the history of Christendom, it would be helpful to look back over the long journey we have already taken. So I'm now going to speak for 2 hours about the previous 8 lectures. Maybe one paragraph. There are few better ways of capturing the whole landscape of history than through the telescopic lens provided by the great historian Christopher Dawson. Dawson speaks of the 6 ages of Christendom. The first age began at Pentecost. The second was the age of Constantine in the 4th century and the granting of religious liberty to Christians. The third began with the missionary efforts of St. Gregory the Great in the late 6th century. The fourth was the age of monasticism, from the Cluniac revival in the 10th century to the rise of the mendicant orders 300 years later. The fifth was the Catholic revival, sometimes called the Counter-Reformation, which arose in response to the Protestant rupture. And the sixth was the age of the strong popes, who led the church's response to the rise of secularist state tyranny. Much that was good in the 20th century was the result of the courageous teaching of the popes in the face of anti-Christian revolution, ideological totalitarianism, and irreligious war. Writing in 1987, church historian Alan Schreck wrote that, quote, "Every pope of the Catholic Church since the middle of the 19th century to the present has been a holy, strong, and gifted leader in his own right," end quote. If anything, this is something of an understatement. It could be argued that every pope since Pius VII, at the very dawn of the 19th century, has been a holy, strong, and gifted leader, making the 19th and 20th centuries something of a golden age of the papacy. It is therefore the popes who will dominate the discussion of what was especially good in the 20th century. The pope at the turn of the century was Leo XIII, whose encyclical Eterni Patris, published in 1879, had laid the foundation for the rise of neo-scholasticism and the consequent return of St. Thomas Aquinas as the universally acknowledged preeminent theologian and philosopher in the church's history. This Thomistic revival would arm the church with the tools of faithful reason it would need to fight the pernicious secularist dogmas of the 20th century. Pope Leo's other enduring achievement was his explication of the church's social teaching in the encyclical Rerum Novarum, published in 1891, which gave the definitive Catholic response to socialism and to free market libertarian capitalism, especially in its elucidation of the twin pillars of subsidiarity and solidarity as the only just solution to economic and political injustice. This document was so important in the century that followed that Pius XI issued his own encyclical, Quadragesimo Anno, on the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum's publication, and St. John Paul II would follow suit with a further encyclical, Centesimus Annus, reiterating the Church's teaching on the centenary of its publication. Following Leo XIII's death in 1903, the saintly Pius X became Pope. He is best known to posterity, and quite rightly, for his resolute defence of the Church from the heresy of modernism, or what we might now call progressivism, within the Church. In essence, Pius X stood firm against those within the Church's hierarchy who wanted the Church to adopt some of the philosophical ideas of the Enlightenment. His stance gained the enthusiastic endorsement of a young English writer, G.K. Chesterton, who denounced the ideas of modernism within the Catholic Church, even though he was not himself yet a Catholic. A popular aphorism ascribed to Chesterton is that we don't want a church that will move with the world. We want a church that will move the world. As a means of countering the errors of modernism, Pius X added his own weight behind the neo-scholastic movement, buttressing the intellectual life of the church and promoting the need for robust catechetical instruction of the faithful. Pius X's successor, Benedict XV, was the reigning pontiff during World War I. He deserves to be remembered primarily as the pope who could have saved the world from the horrors of the following World War, if his words had been heeded. In August 1917, over a year before the war ended, he proposed a peace plan, which was conciliatory in tone and designed to bring both sides to an agreement to end hostilities. The steps he proposed were necessary to end what he called the useless massacre that the war had become, but also to avert the recurrence of such conflicts. His words. Addressing national leaders at the conclusion of his peace proposals, he stressed the gravity of the situation and their personal responsibility for the consequence of ignoring the call to peace. Quote, "On your decisions depend the rest and joy of countless families, the life of thousands of young people. In short, the happiness of the peoples whose well-being it is your overriding duty to procure." End quote. At around the same time as the Pope was issuing his peace proposal, Blessed Karl of Austria, the Emperor of Austria and the King of Hungary, was involved in secret negotiations with the Allied powers aimed at bringing the war to an end. Well may such a holy and peace-loving monarch, a lamb among ravenous, warmongering wolves, have been beatified by the Catholic Church. After the armistice, the Allied powers not only ignored Benedict XV's peace proposals, they excluded him from the International Peace Conference at Versailles, ensuring that his call for reconciliation and justice would not be heard. In the event, the imposition of the egregiously unjust and maliciously vengeful Treaty of Versailles sowed the seeds of the Second World War 20 years later. It was ironic that the refusal of the viciously anti-clerical governments of Italy and France to allow the Pope to be a part of the conference at Versailles led to both their countries suffering the evil consequences of a second war that could have been avoided. The Pope who would preside over the Church in the years between the two world wars was Pius XI, who was elected in 1922 and would die in 1939. His encyclical, Divini Illus Magistri, published in 1929, defended the rights of parents and the Church in education against the encroachments of secularist governments with respect to the schooling of children. In the following year, in Casti Connubii, he issued a robust defence of the Church's timeless teaching on marriage, family, and human life. Ironically, it was published in the very year in which the Anglican Church surrendered to the culture of contraception in its notorious Lambeth Conference, a retreat from orthodoxy which marked the beginning of the inexorable disintegration of the Anglican Communion. In choosing to move with the world, the Church of England had condemned itself to the worldliness which precedes irrelevance and ultimate self-destruction. A year later, as we have seen, Pius XI confirmed the social teaching enunciated in Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum 40 years earlier. In the same year, 1931, Pius XI responded to the boasts of Italy's fascist dictator Benito Mussolini that, quote, the church is not sovereign, nor is it even free, end quote. By insisting on the independence and sovereignty of the church from state control and criticising Mussolini's regime for its persecution of Catholics. Having defied the Italian fascists, Pius XI then turned his attention to the evils of both the Nazis and the communists. In two encyclicals issued a week apart in 1937, he condemned the Nazi government in Germany for its persecution of Catholics, its racism and its anti-Semitism, and for its tribal neo-paganism. In the encyclical against communism, he attacked the evils of Marxism in general and Soviet communism in Russia in particular. Such was the courage and the brilliance of this great pope that papal historian Eamon Duffy, who is not given to grandiloquence or hyperbole in his judgment of character, was uncharacteristically effusive in his praise, end quote. Always a strong man and energetic pope, in the last years of his pontificate, he rose to greatness. The pope of 18 concordats ceased to be a diplomat and achieved the status of a prophet, end quote. As Benedict XV had become pope at the dawn of the First World War, Pius XII ascended to the papal throne as the world descended into a second global conflagration. His first encyclical, Summi Pontificatus, issued shortly after the war had begun, condemned the Nazi and Soviet invasion of Poland, which had caused Britain to enter the war in Poland's defence, as well as condemning anti-Semitism and totalitarianism. Although Pius XII was true to the Church's traditional policy of remaining neutral in times of war, he served the Allied cause in secret by serving as a conduit of communication between the British government and German military leaders contemplating a coup to overthrow Hitler. He also passed on to the Allies intelligence he had received about the imminent Nazi invasion of the Netherlands. Then, during his Christmas address in 1942, he was unequivocal in his criticism of the persecution of the Jews in what would later become known as the Holocaust. Quote, the hundreds of thousands of persons who, without any fault on their part, sometimes only because of their nationality or race, have been consigned to death or a slow decline. End quote. The courage of the Pope's words, considering that he was himself living in the midst of Mussolini's fascist Italy, is a mark of true heroism. After the courageous response of the popes of the first half of the century, the popes of the latter half of the century enjoyed relatively peaceful and uneventful pontificates. For John XXIII, Paul VI, and John Paul II, the war would be fought against the enemies within the church, especially in the manner in which modernist and progressive theologians abused the authentic teaching of the Second Vatican Council in the name of the so-called spirit of Vatican II. We will address this struggle in the next section. First, however, we must praise the role of John Paul II in helping to bring down the Soviet Empire. With respect to John Paul II's place in history, his role in the defeat of Soviet communism is likely to be preeminent. His visit to communist-controlled Poland, his own homeland, in 1979 led to the rise of the Solidarity Trade Union, which would itself lead to the toppling of Poland's communist regime. This led to a domino effect in which one communist country in Eastern Europe after another was overthrown by anti-communist revolutions. By 1991, the resignation of Mikhail Gorbachev signalled the fall of the Soviet Union itself. Although there were other key players in this political process, including Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and the Russian dissident writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, There's no doubt that John Paul II's part in this historical liberation of Europe from the Soviet yoke was crucial. Before we conclude this discussion of the heroism of the popes in the 20th century, we should make note of four important encyclicals issued by John Paul II. The first, Centesimus Annus, 1991, we have already noted. Veritatis Splendor, issued in 1993, reiterated the traditional teachings of the Church on fundamental moral principles. Evangelium Vitae, published in 1995, was an unequivocal defense of human life in the face of the rise of the culture of death, which reinforced the teaching of Paul VI's earlier encyclical, Humanae Vitae, in 1968. Last, but emphatically not least, the encyclical Fides et Ratio, promulgated in 1998, insisted on the indissoluble marriage of faith and reason, which has ever been the foundation of Christian theology and philosophy. At the end of the century, Cardinal Ratzinger, the future Pope Benedict XVI, who had been John Paul II's right-hand man for almost the entirety of the latter's papacy, was working on his seminal work, The Spirit of the Liturgy, presumably with St. John Paul II's blessing, in which he elucidates the definitive principles governing the celebration of the Mass with the brilliance of one of the country's finest minds and one of its greatest theologians. Although the role of the papacy has necessarily been accentuated, there is no escaping the fact that the holiest event of the century was the series of Marian apparitions at Fatima in Portugal between May and October 1917. It is surely no coincidence that these apparitions occurred in the same months in which the communist revolution was happening in Russia, nor can it be anything but providential that the Bolshevik revolution in October of that year coincided with the final apparition at Fatima, in which 70,000 people were present for what has become known as the Miracle of the Sun. As with the priceless gift of her apparition at Lourdes in the previous century, the Fatima apparitions took place during a time of anti-Catholic persecution. In the midst of the darkest hour, in which the diabolical spectre of communism was rising to spread its murderous darkness over the world, the Queen of Heaven comforted her children with the promise of the victory that her Son had already won for those who remained faithful to him. Having focused on some truly holy fathers, we'll end with a litany of the few of the holy women who graced the 20th century, each of whom warrant much more time than we are able to give them. Maria Goretti, Gemma Galgani, Francis Xavier Cabrini, Teresa of the Andes, Faustina Kowalska, Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, Josephine Bakita, Catherine Drexel, Gianna Beretta Mola, and Teresa of Calcutta. Scandalous, I should have just mentioned their names and moved on, but... The bad. There have been so many dark centuries in the history of Christendom that one hesitates to call any particular century the darkest of all. Some have been as dark as the 20th century, but none have been as deadly. In terms of the sheer body count, the 20th century, with its wars of irreligion and its access to industrialized weapons of mass destruction, is the most murderous in human history. It's also amongst the most tyrannous. World War I was the great war of the machines, in which millions of human persons were butchered by new technology. The British brought the newly invented tank to the fray. The Germans used chemical weapons in the form of mustard gas. Both sides employed the recently discovered flying machines. Barbed wire barred the way through no man's land, and more efficient and effective machine guns and artillery ensured carnage on a scale beyond the wildest imaginings of previous generations of warmongers. The harsh and hellish reality of this new form of technology-driven total war was described by Winston Churchill, quote, "Neither peoples nor rulers drew the line at any deed which they thought could help them to win. Germany, having let hell loose, kept well in the van of terror, but she was followed step by step by the desperate and ultimately avenging nations she had assailed. Every outrage against humanity or international law was repaid by reprisals, often of a great scale and of longer duration. The wounded died between the lines, the dead moulded into the soil. Merchant ships and neutral ships and hospital ships were sunk on the seas and all on board left to their fate or killed as they swam. Every effort was made to starve whole nations into submission without regard to age or sex. Winston Churchill. By the end of the war, it's estimated that more than 8 million combatants had been killed and a further 20 million wounded. Under the cover of the darkness of World War I, with the eyes of the world on the carnage of the battlefields, the Ottoman Turks began the systematic extermination of the Armenian Christians in what has become known as the Armenian Genocide. Between 1915 and 1917, somewhere between 600,000 and 1.5 million Armenian civilians, men, women and children were killed. The demonic darkness deepened in October 1917 with the triumph of the communists in the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Yet the violence of the revolution was merely a drop in the ocean of blood that the Soviet communists would spill over the next 74 years of red terror. Under the iron-fisted rule of Lenin, Stalin and their successors, tens of millions of civilians were killed for failing to toe the party line. As with the Reign of Terror after the French Revolution, the sheer scale of the Soviet slaughter illustrates what happens when God is declared to be dead. Marxism was not confined to Russia, however. On the contrary, its atheistic poison spread throughout the world, intoxicating idealistic youth until they became drunk with bloodlust. In Mexico, in the 1920s, it is estimated that around 5,000 Catholics were killed by the anti-Catholic regime. A particularly bloodthirsty hater of Catholics was Governor Sanabal of the Tabasco province, who boasted that every Catholic church in his jurisdiction had been destroyed. He ordered the destruction of the shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe, but the miraculous image was saved, being smuggled to Costa Rica until it could be returned. One hero of the Catholic resistance to the Mexican Revolution was Blessed Miguel Pro, a brave priest who has been described as a real-life Scarlet Pimpernel in his secret ministry to the faithful. When he was finally captured, he was executed. The moment of his death by firing squad was captured on film and in photography by the government to warn of the fate that awaited dissident priests. The plan backfired, however, because the photograph of the priest martyrdom became a holy card, passed from Catholic to Catholic as a token of resistance to the regime. The photograph showed Father Pro moments before he was shot, his arms stretched out like the crucified Christ and with the cry of Viva Cristo Rey on his lips. Far from the photograph serving its propaganda purposes, it was declared illegal for anyone to possess it. Inspired by Miguel Pro's heroism, the people of Mexico rose up in what became known as the Cristero War, reminiscent of the Vendée Rising against the French Revolution. In the following decade, a communist and anarchist republic in Spain waged war on the church. Nearly 7,000 priests were murdered, among them 13 bishops, as were 283 nuns. Unlike the risings in the Vendée and in Mexico, the Catholic nationalist resistance to the Red Terror in Spain led to the Spanish Civil War and the ultimate defeat of the communist tyranny. In 1939, the year in which the Spanish Civil War ended, World War II began. In the two decades since the previous World War had ended, technology had progressed to such a degree that the tools of warfare were more effective and efficient than ever in taking human life. It is estimated that around 24 military personnel were killed, 24 million military personnel were killed, three times as many as in the previous war. This was, however, the less gruesome half of the story. World War II was the first war in human history in which civilians were considered legitimate military targets by both sides. It is estimated that as many as 50 million civilians were killed during the war, many of them by the bombing of cities from the air. Instigated by the Nazis as Blitzkrieg, lightning war, it was used widely against British cities, especially London. It was, however, adopted by the Allies in vengeance, the anti-Christian doctrine of an eye for an eye being the real politic of war. Towards the end of the war, the carpet bombing of the German city of Dresden with incendiary bombs created fires in which those who escaped death by the bomb blast itself were burned alive. It is estimated that around 25,000 civilians were killed. And then, of course, there was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Nagasaki being the oldest Catholic community in Japan, becoming the first cities, so far, thanks be to God, the only cities on which atomic bombs have been dropped. The world transitioned from World War to Cold War. The ensuing arms race led to the development of nuclear weapons so powerful that the atomic bombs which fell on Nagasaki and Hiroshima seemed almost medieval by comparison. This military strategy was known as mutually assured destruction, or MAD, an acronym which speaks for itself. As for the Soviet Empire, it continued its pathological war on the church, imprisoning church leaders for their adherence to the faith. Cardinal Wyszynski in Poland, Cardinal Stepanacz in Yugoslavia, Cardinal Beran in Czechoslovakia, and Cardinal Mindszenty in Hungary. Communism also spread like a murderous cancer throughout other parts of the world. China, Korea, Vietnam, and Cambodia in particular fell victim to its doctrine of death. The Chinese communists, under the tyrannous rule of Mao Zedong, would kill even more people than the Soviets. In Cambodia, Pol Pot, leader of the communist Khmer Rouge, oversaw the murder of 1.7 million of his own people before he was deposed. The 1960s saw the sexual revolution, which would reap havoc. To take but one example of a legion that could be offered, in 1950, before the sexual revolution, only 2% of British babies were born out of wedlock. By 1998, 30 years or so after the revolution, 38% were born outside of marriage. In addition, millions of unborn children have been butchered in the womb as abortion was legalized and encouraged throughout the developed world. In 1968, in the midst of the immoral mayhem and madness of the sexual revolution, Paul VI issued his truly heroic encyclical Humanae Vitae, which was unequivocal in its defense of the procreative purpose of the sexual union. The widespread rebellion against this teaching within the church laid the foundations for the widespread sexual abuse, which would become a pervasive blight by the end of the century. At root, Paul VI was making the necessary connection between chastity and charity. When the former is no longer respected as a necessary virtue, human beings are no longer loved, but are treated as objects to be used and abused. The widespread opposition to Humanae Vitae was a symptom of the spirit of doctrinal apostasy which prevailed at the time. This was encapsulated in the homily preached by Paul VI in 1972, in which he saw the demonic dimension of the so-called spirit of Vatican II, which distorted and perverted the teaching of the Second Vatican Council in the service of modernism and relativism. Quote, through some fissure, Paul VI lamented, the smoke of Satan has entered the temple of God. End quote. Thankfully, and by the grace of God, the tide was turned by the election of John Paul II in 1978. The Catholic Restoration began during his pontificate, in which he was aided and abetted by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, whom he'd chosen as his right-hand man and trusted confidant. The smoke of Satan might have entered the temple, but the gates of hell would not prevail. The beautiful. We're going to start right at the beginning, actually, in the beautiful. On January the 1st, 1900, the first day of the new century, Edward Elgar received a commission to compose a musical setting of St. John Henry Newman's poem, The Dream of Gerontius. The result was one of the masterpieces of the 20th century, in which Elgar unites his genius with that of Newman to bring to dramatic life the story of a soul's transit, assisted by its guardian angel, to the cleansing fires of purgatorial love. Across the Channel in France, the Catholic musical revival was set in motion by St. Pius X's motu proprio on sacred music, Tra la la le solicitudini, forgive me classicists in the audience, issued in 1903, which called for the promotion of Gregorian chant and sacred polyphony in the liturgy. The restoration of the church's musical tradition would influence the works of three young composers who were or who became devout Catholics. These were Maurice Duraflay, François Poulenc, and Olivier Messiaen. Duraflay's Requiem, composed in 1947, is resonant throughout the traditional chants from the Requiem Mass. Francis Poulenc's Dialogue des Carmélites, which premiered in 1957, was inspired by the 16 Carmelite martyrs of Compiègne who were guillotined in 1794 during the Reign of Terror following the French Revolution. Olivier Messiaen was preoccupied with the four last things: death, judgment, heaven, and hell, as is evident in works such as Le Banquet Celeste, The Heavenly Banquet, and the Quatuor pour la fin du temps, Quartet for the End of Time. The latter part of the century was dominated by the holy minimalists, especially Henri Goreski, John Taverner, and Arvo Pärt. Goreski used his gifts in the service of the Catholic resistance to communist tyranny in Poland. His Miserere was written in response to the violence used by communist militia against members of the Solidarity trade union, and his Totus Tuus was composed for John Paul II's third visit to Poland in 1987. Arvo Pärt, as an Estonian, lived in what was then the Soviet Union and suffered accordingly for his Christian faith. His Credo, composed in 1968, was banned by the communist authorities. As a student of Gregorian chant and late medieval polyphony, Pärt's decidedly modern minimalism was nonetheless informed by tradition. For the most part, it didn't last the end of the century, but almost. For the most part, the 20th century signaled the disintegration of the visual arts into formless and meaningless abstraction. Expressing nothing but the angst-ridden narcissism of the artist, it ceased to engage with any objective reality beyond the self. Disconnected from reality, it had nothing to say. Having nothing to say, it says nothing. There were a few noble exceptions to this general death wish on the part of the century's artists. Pietro Annigoni was an unabashed realist, influenced and inspired by the masters of the Renaissance, who distanced himself publicly and controversially from the dominant abstraction, modernism and postmodernism of 20th century art. He was commissioned to paint portraits of Queen Elizabeth, Princess Margaret and other members of the British royal family, as well as portraits of Pope John XXIII and US Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson. A contemporary of Annigoni, who also painted in the realist tradition, was the Scottish painter Sir James Gunn. Like Annigoni, he specialised in portraiture, and also like Annigoni, he was commissioned to paint portraits for the British royal family. His conversation piece at Royal Lodge, Windsor, painted in 1950, shows King George VI seated at table with his wife, Queen Elizabeth, and his two daughters, the princesses Elizabeth and Margaret, the former of whom would become queen 2 years later. Another famous conversation piece executed by Sir James Gunn is Conversation Piece, Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton and Maurice Baring, which shows the three Catholic writers gathered around a table and concentrating on something that Chesterton is writing. Gunn, who was a convert to the Catholic faith, is buried in the same graveyard in Sussex as Hilaire Belloc. Perhaps the most famous artist of the century, with the possible exception of Picasso, is Salvador Dali, who was himself a convert to his own quirky form of Catholicism. His return to tradition and the faith was animated by his disgust and disillusionment with the anarchists and communists of the Surrealist movement with whom he collaborated in his youth. Taking the anti-communist side during the Civil War in his native Spain, his later work is dominated by religious themes. The Dream of Christopher Columbus is triumphalistic in the way it depicts the settlers of the New World as being on a crusade to plant the seeds of the faith on pagan ground. His best-known religious work is, however, Christ of St. John of the Cross, which shows the crucified Christ seen from above, which was inspired by a drawing attributed to St. John of the Cross. Moving from art to architecture and remaining in Spain, the greatest sacred edifice built in the 20th century is the Church of the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, the architect of which, Antoni Gaudí, lived such a holy life that he's become known as God's architect, amidst calls for his beatification. Sagrada Familia is as magnificent as it is singular and strange. A masterpiece which breaks with tradition without compromising form or beauty. The interior is as breathtaking as the famous exterior, the columns adopting organic forms which appear as giant trees, as alive as the gospel, and as evocative to readers of The Lord of the Rings as the elven magic of Lothlorien. The reference to The Lord of the Rings segues the discussion to the great literature of the 20th century. As to The Lord of the Rings itself, the most popular literary work of the century, in terms of sales and most powerful in terms of influence. It was described by its author as, quote, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. It is indeed a testimony to the Catholic literary revival throughout the world that there is a treasure trove of fundamentally religious and Catholic works from which to choose in a century that constitutes a golden age of Catholic literature. Apart from Tolkien's success with The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, the works of Tolkien's friend C.S. Lewis would also prove hugely successful globally. Although Lewis was a convert to Anglican Christianity and is not therefore technically a Catholic, his works are essentially orthodox in their portrayal of Christianity. Staying in England, Chesterton and Belloc were giant figures of the Catholic revival in the first third of the century. Their works would inspire many literary converts to the faith, including Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene. T.S. Eliot, an American who spent most of his life in London, described himself as a Catholic, a royalist, and a classicist. He would prove to be the most influential poet of the century. Other Americans who were either Catholic or were inspired by Catholicism are Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, and Willa Cather, whose Death Comes for the Archbishop is a masterful historical fiction about the pioneering Catholics who evangelized the American West. Returning to Europe, there was a Catholic literary revival in France that paralleled the musical revival which we've already discussed. Writers who graced this revival include François Mauriac, Charles Péguy, Léon Boix, and Georges Bernanos, whose Diary of a Country Priest is a classic of Catholic fiction. The Austrian poet, playwright and novelist Franz Werfel was not a Catholic, but his wonderful novel, The Song of Bernadette, inspired by the Marian apparitions at Lourdes, became an international bestseller, which would be adapted as a very successful film, a whole new medium of art, which is so rich that it must of necessity remain beyond the scope of our present study of history and this talk. Well, very quickly, actually, very quick. It's not much longer, right? So thanks for your patience. But a very quick aside here, because if you don't know the story of the Song of Bernadette, you really need to. Franz Werfel was a very successful Austrian novelist. He was Jewish, and very, very, very revered as a novelist. Because he was Jewish, he went obviously exile, fleeing from the Nazi regime, and was in southern France trying to escape. And of course, when the Nazis invade France, and the route which many people took was over the Pyrenees into Spain, which was neutral. They didn't manage to get out, so they found themselves in this town of Lourdes, he and his wife, and he hears about the apparitions at Lourdes. And in his desperation, although he's Jewish, he prays to the Blessed Virgin, Our Lady of Lourdes, and says that if she will deliver him and his wife from certain death, if they're captured by the Nazis, he would write her story in novel form. So he is delivered and he fulfills the promise. And if you haven't read the Song of Bernadette, it's astonishing to think that's not written by a Catholic. The Norwegian novelist and convert Sigrid Undset deservedly won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1928 for her epic depictions of life in medieval Norway. Last but not least, and with apologies for the inevitable sins of omission, is another winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. This indomitable giant of literature and history exposed the evils of the communist regime in the Soviet Union in a succinctly powerful novella, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, and in weighty historical tomes, such as the three-volume Gulag Archipelago. He stands alongside John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and Margaret Thatcher as a key player in helping to bring down the Soviet Union. A convert from Marxism and atheism to Russian Orthodox Christianity, he epitomized the unbroken spirit of Christendom after 20 centuries of struggle. It was Solzhenitsyn who said that the battle between good and evil takes place in each individual human heart. This battle in each human heart is the battle at the heart of history. It is the battle between the goodness of the saints and the wickedness of the worldly, of those who accept and embrace goodness, truth, and beauty, and those who make the great refusal, choosing instead the path of pride. There is no final victory for one side or the other within the confines of time. The victory or defeat comes at the end of time, which for each of us is the end of our own time, the moment of our death. It is with this contemplation of the last things, which should always be the first things in our mind, we will end this journey through 20 centuries of three-dimensional history. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this podcast. This is Phil Lawler speaking for the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at Thomas More College. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation, and I hope you'll register on our website to receive information about future events hosted by the Center. If you find these recordings helpful, please help us to continue our work by making a tax-deductible contribution. We cannot continue to provide fine programming without the support of people like you, and we're grateful for your help. To receive updates on our activities or to make a contribution to our work, see our webpage at restorationchristianculture.org. That's all lowercase with no spaces or punctuation, restorationchristianculture.org. Thank you again.